From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
How do you ask a man to be the last man to die in Vietnam? How do you ask a man to be the last man to die for a mistake?
From Vietnam War veteran to leading anti-war voice to a backer of George Bush's invasion of Iraq, John Kerry, then and now. Today, in a rare national broadcast, we'll play John Kerry's 1971 speech before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee against the war. And we'll talk to his friend and fellow veteran Brian Wilson about Kerry's transformation and eventual support of the invasion of Iraq.
Mr. President, when I vote to give the President of the United States the authority to use force if necessary to disarm Saddam Hussein, because I believe that a deadly arsenal of weapons of mass destruction in his hands is a threat, and a grave threat to our security and that of our allies in the Persian Gulf region, I will vote because I believe it is the best way to hold Saddam Hussein accountable.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Pentagon announced Thursday it's sending a military team from Southern Command of up to four people to Haiti within the next 2 days. The U.S. is also withdrawing dozens of Peace Corps personnel attached to the embassy and encouraged other Americans to leave the island. Haiti has suffered nearly 2 weeks of violence after gangs and leaders of the 1991 coup staged an armed uprising against the elected government of President Aristide. A spokesperson from the Southern Command said the military team is going to advise the U.S. Embassy on security issues, not to assist the Haitian government. The U.S. has so far rejected pleas from the Aristide government to help end the violence. Washington is also sending representatives to join an international delegation of senior envoys to press Aristide to reach a political compromise with his foes. On Thursday, Aristide said, "I am ready to give my life if that is what it takes to defend my country." Meanwhile, Guy Philippe, a former Haitian police chief who now commands the rebels, vowed his forces would take Aristide's palace if he does not resign soon. A group of scientists, including 20 Nobel laureates, have signed a petition condemning the White House for putting political pressure on governmental scientists. According to the scientists, the White House censors and suppresses reports by its own scientists, stacks advisory committees, and disbands government panels. In business news, former Enron CEO Jeffrey Skilling handed himself over to federal officials. He pleaded not guilty to all charges against him. The U.S. military announced Thursday it'll release five British citizens and a Danish citizen who've been held on Guantanamo Bay for 2 years. The Guardian of London's reporting the British government is preparing to drop its case against Catherine Gunn. Gunn is the 29-year-old employee who leaked information to the press about how the U.S. and Britain were spying on diplomats at the United Nations in the lead-up to the vote for war with Iraq. The city of San Francisco has filed a lawsuit against the state of California, charging the state's laws that bar gay marriage violate language in the state constitution that forbids discrimination. This is Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. On October 10, 2002, Senator John Kerry voted to authorize the invasion of Iraq. A day earlier, Kerry stood on the Senate floor and spoke in favor of the invasion. 30 years earlier, John Kerry became a leading anti-war voice in Vietnam. Kerry returned from Vietnam in April 1969, having won early transfer out of the conflict because of his three Purple Hearts. He'd also won a Silver Star. When Kerry returned home, the number of U.S. troops deployed in Vietnam was 543,000. To that date, 33,400 Americans had been killed, and the number of protests were surging. Kerry gradually became active in the anti-war movement. After working behind the scenes and making a few little noticed appearances at rallies, he joined a group called Vietnam Veterans Against the War. January 1971, the organization held a series of hearings in Detroit called the Winter Soldier Investigation, where hundreds of Vietnam veterans spoke. Kerry did not publicly speak at the event, which received modest press coverage. This is an excerpt of a veteran testifying at those hearings held at a Howard Johnson's in Detroit. The soldier describes what it was like in Vietnam.
You have some testimony here on the burning of villages, cutting off of ears, cutting off of heads, calling artillery on villages for games, women raped, napalm on villages. Could you go into just a few of these to let the people know how you treat the Vietnamese civilians?
The calling in of artillery for games, the way it was worked, would be the mortar forward observers would call in, or we'd pick out certain houses in villages, friendly villages, and the mortar forward observers would call in mortars until they destroyed that house. And then the artillery forward observer would call in artillery until he destroyed another house. And whoever used the least amount of artillery, they won. And then when we got back, someone would have to buy someone else beers. And I saw one case where there were two prisoners, and one prisoner was staked out on the ground, and he was cut open while he was alive. And part of his insides were cutting out. And they told the other prisoner, if he didn't tell them what they wanted to know, that they would kill him. And I don't know what he said because he spoke in Vietnamese, but then they killed him after that anyway.
Were these primarily civilians, or do you believe that they were, or do you know that they were actual...
The way that we distinguished between civilians and VC, VC had weapons and civilians didn't, and anybody that was dead was considered a VC. If you killed someone, they said, how do you know he's a VC? The general reply would be, he's dead, and that was sufficient. The cutting off of heads on Operation Stone, there was a lieutenant colonel there, and two people had their heads cut off and put on stakes and stuck in the middle of the field. And we were notified that there were press covering the operation and that we couldn't do that anymore.
The general attitude of the officers was, I was a lieutenant at the time, well, there's somebody senior to me here, and I guess if this wasn't SOP, he'd be doing something to stop it. And since nobody senior ever did anything to stop it, the policy was promulgated, and everybody assumed that this was what was right. We'd never had any instruction in the Geneva Convention. When we were given our Geneva Convention cards, the lecture consisted of, if you're taken prisoner, all you got to do is give them your name, rank, serial number, and date of birth. Here's your Geneva Convention cards. Go get them, Marines.
Winter Soldier Investigation in 1971. John Kerry declined to speak at the Winter Soldier Investigation hearings, but a bigger stage awaited him. 3 months after the hearings, Kerry took his case to Congress and spoke before a jammed Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Television cameras lined the walls. Veterans packed the seats. Kerry was 27 years old, dressed in his green fatigues, Silver Star, and Purple Heart ribbons. On April 22, 1971, he sat at a witness table and delivered the most famous speech of his life. It was to become the speech that defined him and made possible his political career. Overnight, he emerged as one of the most recognized veterans in America. He instilled fear in President Nixon. Pacifica Radio played his speech on the air. Today, in a rare broadcast, 30 years later, we will play that speech again, almost in its entirety. From the Pacifica Radio Archives, this is John Kerry in 1971.
Several months ago in Detroit, we had an investigation at which over 150 honorably discharged and many very highly decorated veterans testified to war crimes committed in Southeast Asia. Not isolated incidents, but crimes committed on a day-to-day basis with a full awareness of officers at all levels of command. It's impossible to describe to you exactly what did happen in Detroit, the emotions in the room, the feelings of the men who were reliving their experiences in Vietnam. But they did. They relived the absolute horror of what this country, in a sense, made them do. They told the stories of times that they had personally raped, cut off ears, cut off heads, taped wires from portable telephones to human genitals and turned up the power, cut off limbs, blown up bodies, randomly shot at civilians, razed villages in a fashion reminiscent of Genghis Khan, shot cattle and dogs for fun, poisoned food stocks, and generally ravaged the countryside of South Vietnam, in addition to the normal ravage of war and the normal and very particular ravaging which is done by the applied bombing power of this country. We called this investigation the Winter Soldier Investigation. The term Winter Soldier is a play on words of Thomas Paine's in 1776 when he spoke of the sunshine patriot and summertime soldiers who deserted at Valley Forge because the going was rough. And we who've come here to Washington have come here because we feel we have to be winter soldiers now. We could come back to this country and we could be quiet. We could hold our silence. We could not tell what went on in Vietnam. But we feel because of what threatens this country, the fact that the crimes threaten it, not reds and not redcoats, but the crimes which we're committing are what threaten it. And we have to speak out. I would like to talk to you a little bit about what the result is of the feelings these men carry with them after coming back from Vietnam. The country doesn't know it yet, but it's created a monster. A monster in the form of millions of men who have been taught to deal and to trade in violence and who are given the chance to die for the biggest nothing in history. Men who have returned with a sense of anger and a sense of betrayal which no one has yet grasped. As a veteran and one who feels this anger, I'd like to talk about it. We're angry because we feel we have been used in the worst fashion by the administration of this country. In 1970, at West Point, Vice President Agnew said, "Some glamorize the criminal misfits of society while our best men die in Asian rice paddies to preserve the freedoms which those misfits abuse." And this was used as a rallying point for our effort in Vietnam. But for us, his boys in Asia, whom the country was supposed to support, his statement is a terrible distortion from which we can only draw a very deep sense of revulsion and hence the anger of some of the men who are here in Washington today. It's a distortion because we in no way considered ourselves the best men of this country, because those he calls misfits were standing up for us in a way that nobody else in this country dared to. Because so many who have died would have returned to this country to join the misfits in their efforts to ask for an immediate withdrawal from South Vietnam. Because so many of those best men have returned as quadriplegics and amputees, and they lie forgotten in Veterans Administration's hospitals in this country, which fly the flag which so many have chosen as their own personal symbol. And we cannot consider ourselves America's best men when we were ashamed of and hated what we were called on to do in Southeast Asia. In our opinion and from our experience, there is nothing in South Vietnam, nothing which could happen that realistically threatens the United States of America. And to attempt to justify the loss of one American life in Vietnam, Cambodia, or Laos by linking such loss to the preservation of freedom, which those misfits supposedly abuse, is to us the height of criminal hypocrisy. And it's that kind of hypocrisy which we feel has torn this country apart. We are probably much more angry than that, and I don't want to go into the foreign policy aspects because I'm outclassed here. I know that all of you have talked about every possible alternative to getting out of Vietnam. We understand that. We know that you've considered the seriousness of the aspects to the utmost level, and I'm not going to try and deal on that. But I want to relate to you the feeling which many of the men who've returned to this country express. Because we are probably angriest about all that we were told about Vietnam and about the mystical war against communism. We found that not only was it a civil war, an effort by a people who had for years been seeking their liberation from any colonial influence whatsoever, but also we found that the Vietnamese whom we had enthusiastically molded after our own image were hard put to take up the fight against the threat we were supposedly saving them from. We found that most people didn't even know the difference between communism and democracy. They only wanted to work in rice paddies without helicopters strafing them, and bombs with napalm burning their villages and tearing their country apart. They wanted everything to do with the war, particularly with this foreign presence of the United States of America, to leave them alone in peace. And they practiced the art of survival by siding with whichever military force was present at a particular time, be it Viet Cong, North Vietnamese, or American. We found also that all too often American men were dying in those rice paddies for want of support from their allies. We saw firsthand how monies from American taxes was used for a corrupt dictatorial regime. We saw that many people in this country had a one-sided idea of who was kept free by our flag, as blacks provided the highest percentage of casualties. We saw Vietnam ravaged equally by American bombs, as well as by search and destroy missions, as well as by Viet Cong terrorism. And yet we listened while this country tried to blame all of the havoc on the Viet Cong. We rationalized destroying villages in order to save them. We saw America lose her sense of morality as she accepted very coolly a My Lai and refused to give up the image of American soldiers that hand out chocolate bars and chewing gum. We learned the meaning of free fire zones, shoot anything that moves, and we watched while America placed a cheapness on the lives of Orientals. We watched the United States' falsification of body counts, in fact, the glorification of body counts. We listened while month after month we were told the back of the enemy was about to break. We fought using weapons against Oriental human beings with quotation marks around that. We fought using weapons against those people which I do not believe this country would dream of using were we fighting in a European theater, or let us say a non-third world people theater. And so we watched while men charged up hills because a general said that hill has to be taken. And after losing one platoon or two platoons, they marched away to leave the hill for the reoccupation of the North Vietnamese. Because we watched pride allow the most unimportant of battles to be blown into extravaganzas. Because we couldn't lose, and we couldn't retreat. And because it didn't matter how many American bodies were lost to prove that point. And so there were Hamburger Hills and caissons and Hill 881s and Firebase 6s and so many others. And now we're told that the men who fought there must watch quietly while American lives are lost so that we can exercise the incredible arrogance of Vietnamizing the Vietnamese.
Young John Kerry speaking before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee in 1971. We'll come back to his speech in a minute.
Come, you masters of war, you that build the big guns, Yeah, they build the death planes. Yeah, they build all the bombs. Yeah, they hide behind the walls. Yeah, they hide behind discs. I just don't want you to know I can see through your masks. You that never done nothing but build to destroy. You play with my world like it's your little toy. You put a gun in my hand and you hide from my eyes. And you turn and run farther when the fast bullets fly. Like Judas of old.
Masters of War, here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we return to a 27-year-old John Kerry, highly decorated Vietnam veteran, speaking before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee in April 1971.
Each day to facilitate the process by which the United States washes her hands of Vietnam, someone has to give up his life. So that the United States doesn't have to admit something that the entire world already knows. So that we can't say that we've made a mistake. Someone has to die so that President Nixon won't be, and these are his words, the first president to lose a war. And we are asking Americans to think about that. Because how do you ask a man to be the last man to die in Vietnam? How do you ask a man to be the last man to die for a mistake? But we're trying to do that. And we're doing it with thousands of rationalizations. And if you read carefully the president's last speech to the people of this country, you can see that he says and says clearly, but the issue, gentlemen, the issue is communism. And the question is whether or not we will leave that country to the communists or whether or not we will try to give it a hope to be a free people. But the point is, they're not a free people now. Under us, they're not a free people. And we cannot fight communism all over the world, and I think we should have learned that lesson by now. But the problem of veterans goes beyond this personal problem. Because you think about a poster in this country with a picture of Uncle Sam, and the picture says, "I want you." And a young man comes out of high school and says, "That's fine, I'm going to serve my country." And he goes to Vietnam, and he shoots, and he kills, and he does his job. Or maybe he doesn't kill. Maybe he just goes, and he comes back. And when he gets back to this country, he finds that he isn't really wanted. Because the largest unemployment figure in the country, it varies depending on who you get it from, the Veterans Administration, 15%, various other sources, 22%. But the largest figure of unemployed in this country are veterans of this war. And of those veterans, 33% of the unemployed are black. That means one out of every 10 of the nation's unemployed is a veteran of Vietnam. The hospitals across the country won't or can't meet their demands. It's not a question of not trying. They haven't got the appropriations. A man recently died after he had a tracheotomy in California. Not because of the operation, but because there wasn't enough personnel to clean the mucus out of his tube, and he suffocated to death. Another young man just died in a New York VA hospital the other day. A friend of mine was lying in a bed two beds away and tried to help him. But he couldn't. They rang a bell, and there was no one there to service that man. And so he died of convulsions. 57%, I understand 57%, of all those entering VA hospitals talk about suicide. And some 27% have tried. And they try because they come back to this country and they have to face what they did in Vietnam, and then they come back and find the indifference of a country that doesn't really care. That doesn't really care. And suddenly we're faced with a very sickening situation in this country because there's no moral indignation. And if there is, it comes from people who are almost exhausted by their past indignancies, and I know that many of them are sitting in front of me. The country seems to have lain down and accepted something as serious as Laos. Just as we calmly shrugged off the loss of 700,000 lives in Pakistan, the so-called greatest disaster of all times, we are here as veterans to say that we think we are in the midst of the greatest disaster of all times now, because they are still dying over there, and not just Americans, Vietnamese. And we are rationalizing leaving that country so that those people can go on killing each other for years to come. Americans seem to have accepted the idea that the war is winding down, at least for Americans. And they have also allowed the bodies which were once used by a president for statistics to prove that we were winning this war to be used as evidence against a man who followed orders and who interpreted those orders no differently than hundreds of other men in South Vietnam. We veterans can only look with amazement on the fact that this country has not been able to see that there's absolutely no difference between a ground troop and a helicopter crew. And yet people have accepted a differentiation fed them by the administration. No ground troops are in Laos, so it's all right to kill Laotians by remote control. But believe me, the helicopter crews fill the same body bags, and they wreak the same kind of damage on the Vietnamese and Laotian countryside as anyone else. And the president is talking about allowing that to go on for many years to come. And one can only ask if we will really be satisfied when the troops march into Hanoi. We are asking here in Washington for some action. Action from the Congress of the United States of America, which has the power to raise and maintain armies, and which by the Constitution also has the power to declare war. We've come here not to the president, because we believe that this body can be responsive to the will of the people, and we believe that the will of the people says that we should be out of Vietnam now. We're here in Washington also to say that the problem of this war is not just a question of war and diplomacy. It's part and parcel of everything that we are trying as human beings to communicate to people in this country. The question of racism, which is rampant in the military, and so many other questions also. The use of weapons, the hypocrisy in our taking umbrage in the Geneva Conventions and using that as justification for a continuation of this war, when we are more guilty than any other body of violations of those Geneva Conventions, in the use of free fire zones, harassment interdiction fire, search and destroy missions, the bombings, the torture of prisoners, the killing of prisoners, accepted policy by many units in South Vietnam. That's what we're trying to say. It's part and parcel of everything. An American Indian friend of mine who lives on the Indian nation of Alcatraz put it to me very succinctly. He told me how as a boy on an Indian reservation he had watched television and he used to cheer the cowboys when they came in and shot the Indians. And then suddenly one day he stopped in Vietnam and he said, "My God, I'm doing to these people the very same thing that was done to my people." And he stopped. And that's what we're trying to say, that we think this thing has to end. We're also here to ask, we are here to ask, and we're here to ask vehemently, where are the leaders of our country? Where is the leadership? We're here to ask, where are McNamara, Gostow, Bundy, Gilpatrick, and so many others? Where are they now that we, the men whom they sent off to war, have returned? These are commanders who have deserted their troops, and there is no more serious crime in the law of war. The Army says they never leave their wounded. The Marines say they never leave even their dead. These men have left all the casualties and retreated behind a pious shield of public rectitude. They've left the real stuff of their reputations bleaching behind them in the sun in this country. And finally, this administration has done us the ultimate dishonor. They have attempted to disown us and the sacrifices we made for this country. In their blindness and fear, they have tried to deny that we are veterans or that we served in Nam. We do not need their testimony. Our own scars and stumps of limbs are witness enough for others and for ourselves. We wish that a merciful God could wipe away our own memories of that service as easily as this administration has wiped their memories of us. But all that they have done and all that they can do by this denial is to make more clear than ever our own determination to undertake one last mission, to search out and destroy the last vestige of this barbaric war, to pacify our own hearts, to conquer the hate and fear that have driven this country these last 10 years and more. And more. And so when 30 years from now our brothers go down the street without a leg, without an arm, or a face, and small boys ask why, we will be able to say Vietnam, and not mean a desert, not a filthy, obscene memory, but mean instead the place where America finally turned and where soldiers like us helped it in the turning. Thank you.
John Kerry, testifying before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee on April 22, 1971. He was 27 years old. He had just recently returned from Vietnam with 3 Purple Hearts and a Silver Star. After he gave his prepared remarks, he took questions from the senators.
Mr. Kerry, it's quite evident from that demonstration that you're speaking not only for yourself but for all your associates, I would say, as you properly said in the beginning. You said that you wish to communicate. I can't imagine anyone communicating more eloquently than you did. And I think it's extremely helpful and beneficial to the committee and to the country to have you make such a statement. You said you'd been awake all night. I can see that you spent that time very well indeed. Perhaps that was the better part of it. It's better that you be awake than otherwise. You have said that, as you know, the question before this committee and the Congress is really how to end the war. The resolutions which we've been hearing testimony about during the past several days, the sponsors of which are some members of this committee, are seeking the most practical way that we can find, and I believe then to do it at the earliest opportunity we can. That's the purpose of these hearings, and that's why you were brought here. You've been very eloquent about the reasons as to why we should proceed as quickly as possible. Are you familiar with some of the proposals that are before the committee? And
yes, I am, Senator.
You are familiar with them. I would, well, you say for yourself, you do support, or do you have any particular views about any one of them you wish to give to the committee?
My feeling, Senator, is undoubtedly this Congress, and I don't mean to sound pessimistic, but I do not believe that this Congress will, in fact, end the war as we would like to, which is immediately and unilaterally. Therefore, if I were to speak to any, I would obviously say that we must set a date, and the date must be the earliest possible date. But I would like to say in answering that I do not believe it is necessary to stall any longer. I've been to Paris. I've talked with both delegations to the peace talks, that is to say the Democratic Republic of Vietnam and the Provisional Revolutionary Government. And of all 8 of Madam Binh's points, it has been stated time and time again, and was stated by Senator Vance Hartke when he returned from Paris, and has been stated by many other officials of this government, that if the United States were to set a date for withdrawal, the prisoners of war will be returned. I think this negates very clearly the argument of the president that we have to maintain a presence in Vietnam to use as a negotiating block for the return of those prisoners. The setting of the date will accomplish that. As to the argument concerning the danger to our troops, were we to withdraw or state that we would, they have also said many times in conjunction with that statement that all of our troops, the moment we set a date, will be given safe conduct out of South Vietnam. The only other important point is that we allow the South Vietnamese people to determine their own future. And that ostensibly is what we've been fighting for anyway. I would therefore submit that the most expedient means of getting out of South Vietnam would be for the President of the United States to declare a ceasefire, to stop this blind commitment to a dictatorial regime, the Thieu Ky Kiem regime, accept a coalition regime, which would represent all the political forces of the country, which is in fact what a representative government is supposed to do, and which is in fact what this government here in this country purports to do, and pull the troops out without losing one more American, and still further without losing the South Vietnamese.
Senator Symington.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Kerry, move your microphone a little bit, will you?
Which way, sir?
That way. You have a Silver Star, have you not?
Yes, I do.
And you have a Purple Heart?
Yes, I do.
How many clusters on it?
Two clusters.
You've been wounded three times?
Yes, sir.
I have no further questions, Mr. Chairman.
Cindy Aiken.
Mr. Kerry, the Defense Department seems to feel that if we set a definite date for withdrawal, when our forces got down to a certain level, they would be seriously endangered by the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong. Do you believe that the North Vietnamese would undertake to prevent our withdrawal from the country and attack the remaining our troops that remain there?
Well, Senator, if I may answer you directly, I believe that we're running that danger with the present course of withdrawal, because the President has neglected to state to this country exactly what his response will be when we reach the point that we do have, let us say, 50,000 support troops in South Vietnam.
I'm not telling you what I think. I'm telling you what the Department says.
Yes, sir. I understand
now,
that.
Do you think the North Vietnamese would seriously undertake to impede our complete withdrawal?
No, I do not believe that the North Vietnamese would, and that's been clearly indicated at the Paris peace talks that they would not.
You think they might help carry the bags for us?
I would say that they would be more prone to do that than the Army of the South Vietnamese.
No.
John Kerry being questioned by senators. Senator then went on to ask him about Lieutenant William Calley, who had just been convicted weeks before of killing 22 civilians in what became known as the My Lai Massacre.
Wouldn't you agree with me, though, that what he did in herding 20 men, old men, women and children, into a trench and then shooting them was a little bit beyond the perimeter of what even has been going on this war, and that action should be discouraged? There are other actions not that extreme that have gone on and been committed, that if we had not taken action or cognizance of it, that it would have been even worse. It would have indicated we encouraged this kind of action.
My feeling, Senator, on Lieutenant Calley is that what he did, quite obviously, is a horrible, horrible, horrible thing. And I have no bone to pick with the fact that he was prosecuted. But I think that in this question, you have to separate guilt from responsibility. And I think clearly the responsibility for what has happened there lies elsewhere. I think it lies with the men who designed free fire zones. I think it lies with the men who encouraged body counts. I think it lies in large part with this country, which allows a young child before he reaches the age of 14 to see 12,000 violent deaths on television, which glorifies the John Wayne syndrome, which puts out Fighting Man comic books on the stands, which allows us in training to do calisthenics to a four count, on the fourth count of which we stand up and shout kill in unison, which has posters in barracks. In this country, with a crucified Vietnamese with blood on him, and underneath it, it says, kill the gook. And I think that clearly the responsibility for all of this is what has produced this horrible aberration. Now, I think that if you are going to try Lieutenant Calley, then you must at the same time, if this country is going to demand respect for the law, you must at the same time try all those other people who have responsibility. And any aversion that we might have to the verdict as veterans is not to say that Calley should be freed, not to say that he's innocent, but to say that you can't just take him alone.
John Kerry, 27 years old, decorated Vietnam veteran, speaking before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee on April 22nd, 1971. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
You will not be able to stay home, brother. Not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials, because the revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by Xerox in four parts without commercial interruptions. The revolution will not show you pictures of Nixon blowing a bugle and leading a charge by John Mitchell, General Abrams, and Spiro Agnew to eat hog maws confiscated from a Harlem sanctuary. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by the Schaefer Award Theater and will not star Natalie Woods and Steve McQueen or Bullwinkle and Julia. The revolution will not give your mouth sex appeal. The revolution will not get rid of the nub. The revolution will not make you look 5 pounds thinner, because the revolution will not be televised, brother. There will be no pictures of you and Willie Mae pushing that shopping cart down the block on the dead run, or trying to slide that color TV into a stolen ambulance. NBC will not be able to predict the winner at 8:32 on the Fort from 29 districts. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of Whitney Young being run out of Harlem on a rail with a brand new process. There will be no slow motion or still life of Roy Wilkins strolling through Watts in a red, black, and green liberation jumpsuit that he has been saving for just the proper occasion. Acres, Beverly Hillbillies, and Hooterville Junction will no longer be so damn relevant, and women will not care if Dick finally got down with Jane on Search for Tomorrow, because black people will be in the street looking for a brighter day. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no highlights on the 11 o'clock news and no pictures of Harry R. Woman Liberationist and Jackie Onassis blowing her nose. The theme song will not be written by Jim Webb or Francis Scott Key, nor sung by Glenn Campbell, Tom Jones, Johnny Cash, Engelbert Humperdinck, or The Rare Earth. The revolution will not be televised.
The revolution will not be televised. Gil Scott Heron here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn now to Brian Wilson, a longtime friend of John Kerry. He's recently written a letter to Senator John Kerry on Iraq. It begins, "Dear John, it's been a long time since we have had contact. As you might remember, our first meeting was at Vietnam Veterans Against the War's Dewey Canyon 3, a limited incursion into the country of Congress, April 19th to 23rd, 1971 in Washington, D.C. I'm sure you remember asking the Senate that week in an impassioned speech, how do you ask a man to die for a mistake? You also stress the importance of being totally nonviolent. That's the opening paragraph of the open letter that Brian Wilson has written to Senator John Kerry. We just listened, Brian Wilson, to the speech that John Kerry gave before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, April 22nd, 1971. We don't have much time, but if you can talk about your experience with John Kerry then and how you have worked with him over the years, leading to this open letter of very fierce criticism about where he stood on the invasion of Iraq.
Well, good morning, Amy. I listened to that speech. I was standing outside the Fulbright's hearing room on April 22nd, 1971, and I was ecstatic, and I was empowered, and I was validated. I was like most of the other veterans that were there at Dewey Canyon 3, I was going through my first phases of shock and trying to tell the truth. And here was a patrician, no less, John Kerry, who was a spokesperson that really did capture our sentiments in a way that we couldn't have imagined. So that was my, you know, first days with John Kerry. And I have never forgotten the end of his speech, which I guess was played, he played it, his declaration that we want to take one last mission to reach out and destroy the last vestige of this barbaric war, and that we want to be part of where America finally turned and soldiers like us helped in the turning. Well, I and other veterans that I work with have never forgotten it, and we still are on the path working for the turning. I didn't spend any time with John Kerry after that week until 1982, when I worked with him when he was Lieutenant Governor of Massachusetts and I was directing a veteran outreach center in the state. And we and other groups of veterans, myself included, were having regular consultations with John Kerry, mostly on veterans issues. And then Senator Paul Tsongas, who was the senator, one of the senators from Massachusetts at the time, had developed cancer, and he was going to have to step down. So John Kerry immediately decided to run for the Senate. And I and about 12 or 15 other veterans worked on his primary campaign against a very progressive Massachusetts congressman, Jim Shannon. And then he just barely beat Shannon, and then he ran against Ray Shamey, a wealthy Republican businessman, in the general election. Now, when he was running for the Senate his first term, he was very clear that he was for arms reduction, nuclear freeze, U.S. out of Central America. He wanted to cut the defense budget in very specific ways. He wanted to eliminate the MX missile, the space weapons program, binary nerve gas, the M1 Abrams tanks, and a whole list of weapon systems and various, even airplanes, F-16, B-1 bomber, B-2 stealth bomber, and so forth. He wanted to control acid rain and hazardous waste. He was very explicit. So I didn't have any real reasons to doubt that he was still on that path at that time. And even in the primary debate with Shannon, he was telling Shannon that Shannon had made a mistake when he voted for the MX missile, and Shannon admitted that he'd made a mistake. And then Kerry said, as I remember, "I fought in a mistake called Vietnam. How can we have confidence that you won't make more mistakes?" Well, John Kerry has made huge mistakes. His hugest mistake was his vote on October 11th, 2002, to basically unconstitutionally delegate war authority to Bush II for war declaring, giving the president war declaring power which only Congress can do that with a declaration of war. Basically, unlawfully transferred to the president the decision-making power of whether to launch a first strike invasion of Iraq. And had bought all the deceptions, hook, line, and sinker, almost in a fashion to become a Bush cheerleader, if you read his October 9th speech the night before the vote. And I was shocked.
Brian Wilson,
a lot of other things about John that have been disturbing.
Brian Wilson, I wanted to play just a clip of the speech that Senator John Kerry gave on the House, on the Senate floor, October 9th, 2002.
Mr. President, when I vote to give the President of the United States the authority to use force if necessary to disarm Saddam Hussein, because I believe that a deadly arsenal of weapons of mass destruction in his hands is a threat, and a grave threat to our security and that of our allies in the Persian Gulf region. I will vote because I believe it is the best way to hold Saddam Hussein accountable.
That was Senator John Kerry, October 9, 2002, Brian Wilson.
56 other congressmen and senators that could see through the deception and voted no on that resolution. And John always was at least an intelligent person. He was law trained, and it's just strange that he couldn't see what many other people could see, including most of his constituents in Massachusetts, who he literally refused to meet with over and over again. And I think it's ironic that he sits on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee today and was overseeing or was participating in hearings in 2002 about Iraq, receiving voluminous evidence questioning the veracity of the allegations of Bush 2 on the weapons of mass destruction, presence of nuclear weapons, and so forth. And that was the same committee that he was speaking before 33 years ago, asking that committee serious questions about the war in Vietnam, and how can you ask a man to be the last man to die for a mistake? So I'd like John Kerry to answer the question of who is going to be the last man to die for his mistake, and is he going to acknowledge that he's made a terrible mistake and hold himself accountable as he is going to be holding Bush accountable? Obviously, Bush is extremely vulnerable. But Kerry himself is very vulnerable, and I don't know whether his ability to kind of have it both ways will work as he is cross-examined harshly, I'm sure, by the Bush people down the road. I think Kerry's his biggest strength is Bush's vulnerability. And if Kerry would make himself less vulnerable, I think he would be a shoo-in. But I'm concerned about a lot of his positions, and he's also one of the largest recipients of special interest monies, which is another concern. But he voted for the Patriot Act. He voted for Homeland Security. He has not shown leadership from a senator who has basically had a kind of a safe seat. So he hasn't shown courage.
Well, he's had very close races.
Pardon me?
He had a very close race against William Weld.
Yes, it's 96, but 2002 he didn't have any kind of opposition. So after 96, when he seemed to step up his rhetoric seemed to become harsher after 96. And certainly nobody did emerge in 2002 that seriously challenged Kerry. So his rhetoric simply became more Bush-like, more hawk-like. And this is disturbing. It's very disturbing.
Brian Wilson, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Brian Wilson, former U.S. Air Force captain who served in Vietnam, first met John Kerry in 1971, fellow veterans protesting on Capitol Hill. In 1987, Brian Wilson lost both his legs as he lay down across our railroad tracks to prevent a military train in California from from getting weapons to Central America to protest the support of the Contras there. And we're going to wrap up today's program on this day, the day before the 39th anniversary of the assassination of Malcolm X. We're going to turn to one of his most famous speeches. He gave it a year before he was gunned down in Detroit. The name of the speech, The Ballot or the Bullet.
Once you change your philosophy, you change your thought pattern. Once you change your thought pattern, you change your attitude. Once you change your attitude, it changes your behavior pattern. And then you go on into some action. As long as you got a sit-down philosophy, you'll have a sit-down thought pattern. And as long as you think that old sit-down thought, you'll be in some kind of sit-down action. They'll have you sitting in everywhere. It's not so good to refer to what you're going to do as a sit-in. Then right there, it castrates you. Right there, it brings you down. What goes with it? What, think of the image of someone sitting. An old woman can sit. An old man can sit. A chump can sit. A coward can sit. Anything can sit. Well, you and I have been sitting long enough, and it's time today for us to start doing some standing and some fighting to back that up. When we look at other parts of this earth upon which we live, we find that black, brown, red, and yellow people in Africa and Asia are getting their independence. They're not getting it by singing, "We Shall Overcome." No, they're getting it through nationalism. It is nationalism that brought about the independence of the people in Asia. Every nation in Asia gained its independence through the philosophy of nationalism. Every nation on the African continent that has gotten its independence brought it about through the philosophy of nationalism. And it will take black nationalism that to bring about the freedom of 22 million Afro-Americans here in this country where we have suffered colonialism for the past 400 years. America is just as much a colonial power as England ever was. America is just as much a colonial power as France ever was. In fact, America is more so a colonial power than they, because she's a hypocritical colonial power behind it. What is 20th? What do you call second-class citizenship? Why, that's colonization. Second-class citizenship is nothing but 20th century slavery. How are you going to tell me you're a second-class citizen? They don't have second-class citizenship in any other government on this earth. They just have slaves and people who are free. Well, this country is a hypocrite. They try and make you think they set you free by calling you a second-class citizen. No, you're nothing but a 20th century slave.
Malcolm X speaking a year before he was gunned down in Detroit, 1964. That does it for today's program. If you'd like to get a video or audio copy, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, Jeremy Scahill, Mike DeFilippo, and Rich Kim are our engineers. Our website is democracynow.org. If you'd like to get a copy of, if you'd like to join our daily digest list, find out the news stories that we're doing, working on, and links that you can go to, sign up at Daily Digest, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.